more than we could produce. So I started buying eggs from other farmers and candling them. I don't know if you know it, but yes, candling yes. is a method. I didn't know what to, I wouldn't even recognize the words then, but it was a quality control technique. And I had to get a car that I could deliver these things in. So I bought a second-hand car, and I debt financed it really by agreeing to give the owner a share of the profit from the eggs. Well, it all sounds, I mean, we were talking about nickels and dimes and dollars, but the principles were the same. And I think I learned from that experience when I was a boy.
That's really interesting, you know. I've worked on farms, but I never thought about a farm in that sense that you've just described, but it's certainly very appropriate. You went to Europe, I think in 1954, somewhere in there, to examine a number of different gas-producing operations there, and eventually ended up in Air Products licensing ammonia production.
Yeah, what happened at that time was that the use of fertilizer on American farms was increasing, and in Europe they used massive amounts of nitrogen fertilizer compared to this country. But they demand the growth in the ammonia business, which really took off here during World War II, when there were government plants for producing ammonia and ammonium nitrate for explosives based on the same kind of contracts that we eventually had. Our original contracts to build and operate under government contract the liquid oxygen plants for the defense were based on contract patterns that had been established during the war to produce ammonia for ammonium nitrate. And so then when the war ended, that ammonia capacity existed. Farms in this country began to use it more, and the demand grew. And in Europe, we knew that they purified coke oven gas to get the source of hydrogen for producing ammonia, and we saw a potential market for that, and so we went over there and looked at some plants in Germany and Britain and the Netherlands and Belgium, France, and eventually, after several months, entered into a contract with the Dutch state mines to get their know-how for doing that in the United States, and we began and we sold plants to a U.S. steel plant out in Utah and a couple places. But in the meantime, that business didn't develop as we had thought it might develop, because the natural gas pipelines were being laid all over the country, and natural gas from the Texas and Louisiana Gulf Coast was reaching out every place, and the cost of reforming natural gas as a source of hydrogen for ammonia rendered the other business non-competitive. And so we didn't pursue that. And in the meantime, the Cold War had raised the opportunity for the liquid oxygen production, and that took up a lot of our attention. But we were always dabbling around in hydrogen, and the hydrogen story grew out of that. It's, I think, an interesting story. Maybe it's in thin air, I'm not sure. At first, the U.S. military was operating these U-2 spy planes, remember, over the Soviet Union and elsewhere. And they were operating on conventional jet fuel, and they could operate up to an altitude of 25,000 feet or something. And the American military knew that the Soviet anti-aircraft capability was improving, and so they made the Air Force made a very secret development program with the Skunk Works out at Lockheed. I got this book. I've only read a little bit of it so far. They were to develop. It was clear that if you had hydrogen fuel, you could operate a jet engine on very thin fuel air ratios and get up to 60,000-70,000 feet. So they gave Lockheed the secret contract to develop a Super U-2. They gave us contracts to develop the liquid hydrogen, and they gave Pratt & Whitney the contract to develop the engine. And we were we're having our annual meeting. We moved from different parts of the country, and this year it's at Tampa. And we're going to start tomorrow at noon and go through noon on Sunday, so they're all busy getting things organized. So where were we now then?
We were talking about the hydrogen.
Oh, yeah. And so they gave Pratt & Whitney the contract for the engine, and we had contracts, all highly classified, for what we called the first little small unit was called Baby Bear, and then there was a bigger unit called Mama Bear, and then a super unit called Papa Bear, which was hidden over in the floor of the Florida Everglades. To make then fantastic sum of amount of 30 tons per day of liquid hydrogen for this program. Well, we were going ahead full speed. Lockheed was going, Pratt & Whitney was going, and the U-2 was shot down over Russia, and Eisenhower denied it, and then the Russians produced the pilot, and so it was an embarrassment to the United States, and the Super U-2 program was canceled. But in the meantime, engineers at Pratt & Whitney and Lockheed and elsewhere were harking back to the our earlier explorations had shown that the Germans were experimenting with liquid hydrogen rockets. They were using liquid oxygen for the bombs on Britain, but they were doing experiment on very high altitude, and it was clear from the science of rocketry that if you had liquid hydrogen for the upper stages, that you could get into orbit and put up the space station or whatever. And so that the availability of the liquid hydrogen then stimulated the R&D on liquid hydrogen rockets, and that drew us into the rocket field, and the aerospace companies did the development on the propulsion systems, but we built several large liquid hydrogen plants with government contracts in California and elsewhere, New Orleans for the testing center over here. And when we built when we started putting in the facilities to produce hydrogen at New Orleans for the government contract, and we had plants there for producing oxygen for the government contracts and nitrogen waste byproduct, hey, we got hydrogen and nitrogen, we can make ammonia. So we then went ahead and put in, and we had been building the ammonia production up till then was all based on the old Haber-Bosch process with like very high pressures. But people had, American Cyanobit and others, had developed catalysts which enabled producing, getting ammonia synthesis to go at, say, 200 or 300 pounds pressure. And we had been, as the scale of the hydrogen and oxygen plants went up in size, we had departed from the old high-pressure reciprocating compressors, which are very expensive, substituted centrifugal compressors. And so we saw a way to cut the cost of producing ammonia using some of these byproducts, running at low pressure from, I don't remember the numbers anymore, from maybe $20 a ton to $12 a ton or something like that. So we put in at New Orleans the first large-scale low-pressure ammonia plant, and so we had a leading edge in that technology and application, but we didn't have the capacity to exploit that. We had too many other things, didn't have the people. We were growing at 15% a year compounded, and we just didn't. So others went on and developed that technology on a wide scale in the ammonia industry. But then we took the liquid hydrogen and began commercial development for selling that to the private sector, and in due course Lindy came along behind us. But we have a dominant position in that liquid hydrogen market worldwide now, and it's a big business. It's probably $1 billion worldwide in the commercial side.
When you got into a new area like liquid hydrogen, and I wanted to ask you about fluorine as well for the space program, you're really talking about a whole nother step in technology that you have to develop.
Yeah.
Oxygen was it, but when you get the hydrogen and fluorine, the technology has got to be quite different. How do you handle that? How do you find people who are...
Well, it was a perpetual struggle, but the people, you put your finger on the thing, the people are the key issue, and I recognize that. I guess from 1950 on, for 30-odd years, A year never went by when I wasn't on several college campuses lecturing to engineering and science students, and really recruiting is what it was, although we didn't call it that, and encouraging everybody else in the company to do it. Some people don't like to do that, and a lot of people don't like to do that, and it isn't easy to get a corporate body like Air Products. We had some very good active participants. Dexter was one. But many people in the company didn't like to do that, particularly the technical recruiting side. And then we had to search out some people with specific skills that we didn't have. Jim Roth was one, and Tim O'Brien was an enormously valuable. I don't know if you know about Jim Roth.
Yes, so. Yes.
And it was hard to recruit a person like Jim Roth because we didn't have a community of peers and so that was hard to do. But then he was a valuable person. Tebow retired about a year or so ago. He was 65 years old. He was a Louisiana boy, went to LSU, went to MIT and got a master's and doctor's degree in chemical engineering, and was on the MIT faculty and was a consultant for us. And then finally we recruited him and induced him to come to Air Products, and he changed the nature of engineering in the company. Tebow was not a manager, but Tebow O'Brien knows and knew then the fundamental academic principles of graduate schools of chemical engineering. And he brought that know-how and then brought several others along. And so he professionalized the engineering side of the company. Nat Robertson did the same thing on the chemistry side. Nat Robertson, he retired several years ago too. He's a chemist with a PhD from Princeton, and he was in the old Spencer Chemical Company. That's where we met him with the ammonia production, and then they were acquired by Gulf Oil, and that giant corporation with their hundreds of scientists and so forth, that didn't fit into that. And we got him to come, and he had the title for several years of Vice President of Research and Development. And that was like Tebow, not a manager, but rather a person who brought the understanding of the professional chemist. And it was particularly Nat is a shy kind of person. He didn't like to go out and deal with the commercial world, but he had an innate judgment that whether this R&D effort would lead to commercial success. And so those two men played very instrumental roles in helping us professionalize those sectors.
When you're out on a college campus recruiting a young engineer just getting his degree, what do you look for? How do you tell that someone's going to fit into the culture of Air Products?
Well, I always felt, and we adhered to this, that the person with academic excellence was primary. Now, if in addition he, and they were mostly he in those days, had other campus activities, was involved in lots of things, and had leadership roles, that made it ever more attractive. And we set very rigorous standards. We didn't offer unless people were at the very top of their class. I mean, some of the practices we followed, you'd get in trouble with the EEO people about today. But that's what we did. Sorry about that.
That's right.
And the recruiting, I think it's very important to think about that. The recruiting of these really gifted people who are at the top of their class academically and had other skills, and doing that year after year. If you read security analyst reports, over the years that's been frequently cited as a thing that prevented depth and breadth of management in the company. And you can see it now. Dexter ran the company after I did, and Hap Wagner does now. Those guys were products of that system, and they're surrounded by people who were counterparts of them during their same chronology.
You often, and I don't think this person would fit into what you're saying, but there are times when you're going to find someone who's quite brilliant, but prefers to be more work alone as opposed to interacting with others.
That's right, yeah.
How do you deal with that situation?
Well, a lot of those people, sometimes it doesn't work out, you know. I began this recruiting when I was still at Lawrence Tech. And the guy that was the valedictorian of our class, Arthur Harbeck, I recruited him. He came to Air Products, but he didn't stick around. He just didn't have the dynamic personality. The person who did was Jack Grafey. This is such an interesting human relations story that I ought to tell you that. When I went to Lawrence Tech, in 1939, one of the people I first encountered was this fellow Jack Grafey. He was 6 months younger than I, something like that, and he didn't speak any English. He had just come from Germany, and his mother they were not Jews, but his mother hated Hitler, and she smuggled this 17-year-old boy out of Germany and came to Detroit, where her brother was one of the people with Dr. Lawrence in the faculty. And so Jack was trying to go to engineering school and learn English at the same time. And I went on through and got my degree in 4 years. Took him 5 years to get his degree because he was learning English. And but when about the time I came to work at Air Products, well, I got him to come to work at Air Products, and he worked part time. And then when he got his degree, he worked full time. And then we went to Tennessee, and we were both deferred. He had applied for and become a citizen. We were both deferred during the war, and then when the war ended, that was it as far as I was concerned. But within 2 or 3 weeks of the time the war ended, Jack was drafted. And they took him, they put him in military intelligence back in his hometown of Stuttgart, where he could talk to the Germans just like, he was a German. And so he was in the service for 2 or 3 years. And then he came to Pennsylvania, met a girl there, married, had 2 or 3 children, and had 4 children, in fact. And then the sad part was that Jack had severe arterial problems and these blood clots like Dan Quayle just had, except Jack had them in spades. And he and his wife and their small children were sent over to England. He was in charge of the engineering department in Great Britain. And he had these severe life-threatening illnesses where he'd have to go in the hospital and they'd just all this thing. And he came over here, and he went to Houston, to the DeBakey Center, and they told him that they had an experimental system where they could take I guess it was an artery, or maybe it's a vein, I've forgotten which, artery, I guess, and they would go into his leg where he had the thigh, where he had the most severe problems, and they put this experimental plastic tubing in there, and but if he didn't do that, he stood a chance of dying, a sudden death. And but because they didn't know if they would be able to do it successfully, he would, before going under the anesthesia, he would have to sign a release so that if necessary they would amputate his leg. Well, he came up to our home in Allentown. Inez and I were there on a Saturday, and he stayed overnight, and it was a Friday night he stayed, and all day Saturday, and agonizing over this decision, and he wanted me to give him some advice, which I absolutely wouldn't do. And finally he called Gloria, his wife, in London, and ask her to take a flight to Houston, and they'd meet there Monday, and they'd go through with this. And so Saturday afternoon, I had a company car take him to Kennedy Airport for a flight to Houston. He wanted to go from Kennedy. And Monday morning he called me, and he was back in London. He got to Kennedy, and I think that's why he wanted to go to Kennedy in the first place. Decided he didn't want to do it, called his wife, took a flight to London. Well, 6 or 7 months later, we were building a plant in Finland. And Jack was in a hospital in a hotel in Helsinki. In the middle of the night, he called the desk and said, "Send a doctor." And they sent a doctor, and he was dead. So his wife then came home. In the meantime, I told you earlier that Leonard Poole's wife had died. Gloria and Grafy came home with their 4 children. And Leonard's wife had been gone for a few years, and they started dating and were married.
Mm.
They'd known each other for all these years. They were married. And they were married for 10 years or so, I guess, before Leonard died. Mm. That's how these little companies get, people get intertwined with each other.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, let me follow that for a moment. Would you say that Air Products, as it grew, had a family orientation to it?
Yeah, it doesn't have that anymore. And I didn't try to preserve that. In fact, I introduced rules that were toward professionalization. I introduced rules against the employment of relatives, of children of employees, and for example, and where if we had spouses working in a company, one didn't report to the other but worked in different departments, and movements of that kind to try and because it was getting too big to operate, what I thought, and I think I was right, as a family structure, it needed to have a professional management structure.
I'm going to wait till the clock finishes chiming.
Seems like it chimes forever.
I have clocks also, so I guess. Were you instrumental in urging that the company get into chemicals?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got to the point then where we